We now had the exact nature of the wrong we would talk about to another human being in step five. In the fifth column, we had the character defects we'd be willing to turn loose of in step six. In the fifth column, we had the shortcomings we're going to ask God to take away in step seven. And then quite naturally, many of the names in column one were people and institutions we had harmed. So they came off of column one to be added to a sheet to be used later on for steps eight and nine. So we really gathered up all the information we needed for steps four, five, six, seven, eight, and nine, resentment-wise. Now, we don't want to give you the impression, though, that you can always be 100% resentment-free. I don't think God ever gave us anything that's bad. It's what we do with it which determines whether it becomes bad or not. A resentment used for the right purpose can be something good. For instance, if somebody does something to threaten my self-esteem and it causes me to take a look at myself and causes me to see some changes I need to make, then a resentment can be used for a worthwhile purpose. Let me give you for instance. Let's say we're living in the neighborhood. All the old houses are run down. They all need painting. They all have some broken window panes, torn window screens. Mine's no worse than anybody else's. I'm very complacent about that situation. I go home from work in the evening. I sit on my front porch, and I rock, and I rock, and I rock, and I'm sitting there as happy as I can be. But one day I look up, and some idiot has moved in across the street. He's out there painting his house. He's fixing his window screens. He's fixing the broken window panes. I resent the hell out of him for doing that. I say, who the hell is he moving in here screwing up the whole damn neighborhood? But if I use that resentment right, it'll cause me to look at my house and I'll become a little bit ashamed of it. Next thing you know, I paint my house, fix up the window screens and the window panes. My next door neighbor, he resents me for doing so. Next thing you know, he fixes up his house. After a while, God's got the whole neighborhood cleaned up like it should have been in the first place. That's the proper use of a resentment. But we alcoholics won't use it that way. We'll sit on our front porch and we'll rock and we'll rock and we'll resent and we'll resent. 30 days later at midnight, we'll go over and burn his damn house down. We'll show him. We'll not always be completely free of resentments, but at least we can get them to the level that God intended for them to be in the first place. Joe?
Talking about those resentments, and the explanation of the resentment, he said, from it, the word resentment, from it stem all forms of spiritual disease. And that's what happened to me. I become resentful in every area of my life because my mind was resentful. You can't just have a resentment here. When I get resentful, I'm resentful everywhere. So my whole deportment was that of a resentment. You notice on the page 65, besides what part of self was affected, fear is mentioned about six different times. If we have resentments, then we have fears, or lots of fears. My whole nature become fearful. So all my decisions about everything was bent up on having tens with resentment and fear. Every one of them was making those decisions based on that basis, which has got to turn out to be wrong because of resentment and fear is not normal, really. But on page 18, if we will, go back to page 18, and we're going to be talking about fears this morning, and we're not going to get into the habit of psychoanalyzing ourselves. A lot of people are doing that. Yeah.
Because we're moving off of this, I just want to ask one quick question about doing resentment inventory, 4 through 9, or, the inventory. You have review of resentments, fears, sex conduct, other non-sex conduct. Should I do column 1 for all 4, then do column 2 for all 4?
No. Do resentments first.
Just do resentment 1.
Yeah, 1, 5, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, I thought you meant to do the column. Yeah, do one column at a time, top to bottom, till you work your way across. Right, then go to the fear. Right, right. Always, yeah, thank you. Anybody else have any questions? Well, feel free to ask. That's good. But anyhow, we're not going to say that the reason we have all these fears is because Mommy set us on the potty chair backwards or something. We're not going to psychoanalyze ourselves in that manner. Can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind anyhow. That's futile. But what we are going to do is we're going to do what the big book has suggested. We're going to find the facts. We're going to face the facts. We're going to engage in the process to accept the facts. Remember, it said that when the spiritual malady, the word malady means illness, when the spiritual illness is overcome, not only our religious or spiritual nature, but our own moral fiber, that's what we're trying to heal up also. When our own moral fiber is straightened out, we straighten out mentally and physically, and this is an attempt to do all that. And remember, Dr. Jung told Roland that ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the guiding force of life, these people are suddenly cast on one side. And during our inventories, we're looking at ideas, emotions, and attitudes. And that's all we're looking for. On page 18, that first paragraph was my whole story, really, in one paragraph. It says, an illness of this sort, and we've come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employees, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents, and anyone can increase the list. In other words, alcoholism is a family illness. And if you live with one of us very long, you're going to be affected by it. Normally, not very good, adversely. And I look back in my life and I see that my dad was an alcoholic. I didn't know that in the beginning. I thought he was a no-good, rotten SOB. But he was an alcoholic. And he had an obsession to drink. And my mother had an obsession to see that he didn't drink. And I grew up in this. And it was not nice. Seemed like every time my dad took a drink, my mother had a personality change. Like that. And we know that alcoholism is a progressive illness. It gets worse over a period of time. And they used to fuss and fight about my dad's drinking. And he was an ice man back in the 30s and late 30s and early 40s. And carrying ice to people's houses. Backbreaking work, hard work. 6 days a week, hardly any money. He'd come home on Saturday afternoon late and he'd buy a pint of whiskey, homemade whiskey there. And he'd have a drink. And I think he deserves a drink today. I mean, man might work that hard, ought to have a drink if he wants one. And he did. And she saw that $2 taking food away from her family, her kids. And they'd fuss and fight about that. And eventually, my dad began to talk real ugly to my mother, and she talked ugly to him, and I was affected by that emotionally. I watched that happen. And they began to fuss and fight about things. And I grew up in this and was affected by it emotionally. And eventually my dad's drinking got to be so bad that he would threaten my mother physically and threaten her with a gun or threaten her with a knife and things. And I saw these things happening. And eventually sometimes he would tell us kids, he said, boys, I'm going to take your mom out and kill her this weekend. And I'm less than 7 years old, and I think he's going to do that. And I'm affected by it emotionally. Have to be. They'd be gone all weekend. And I wouldn't see him anymore till late Sunday night. And I'm wondering if he did it this time. And I used to eat my fingernails all the way down to the quick, wondering and worrying about those things. So it affected me emotionally. And I grew up in this. Eventually, my mother had to have my dad arrested. And that's what they did with alcoholics of our type in those days. And they committed him to Eastern State Hospital in Bonita. Didn't have any alcoholic treatment facilities in those days. But what they did have was a criminally insane ward. And my dad was an alcoholic. And he was committed to the criminally insane ward. And he was to stay there till he got well. Think about that. He'd be there a while. And my dad was there for 3 years and 7 months and 13 days. The most formidable years of my life. He went in when I was about seven. And it affected me emotionally, too. My brother and I used to hitchhike up there and take him a couple of dollars and a carton of cigarette from time to time and go back on the building three, back on the fifth floor in the rear. And I saw things back there you're not supposed to see. Terrible, terrible things. And I began to get a bunch of ideas, emotions, and attitudes which would become a guiding force of my life. And I'm just 7 years old. And I told you yesterday, one of my ideas was, if God, got to blame it on somebody, right? If God is going to do this to me and us, to hell with him. If I ever get big enough they can't catch me, I'm not going. Now, I came up with that idea all on my own by myself. Nobody helped me with that. I'm good at that. And another thought came to me one day was, man, if it hurts like this to love people, I'm not going to love anybody anymore. It hurts too bad. And I began to push people out of my life. I got real good at that, too. And another thought came to me one day was, if anything good is going to happen in my life, it's because I, all alone, without any help, made it that way. So I didn't need God, nothing, or nobody. And I thought those were very brave attitudes on my part for many a day. Come to find out, the most fearful attitudes you could possibly have. But I did not know that. No one to talk to about it. They put you in jail. Those are not very good coping skills, by the way. They put you in jail for those kind of attitudes. They did that for me. Put you in prison for those things. They did that for me. They divorce you for that. Those same attitudes, they did that for me. So when I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, I was very, very fearful, extremely resentful, and I did not know all those things. I didn't know that I was affected that way. I didn't know how to think any other way. Who would have taught me? How would I have known? And so that's what we're looking at, ideas, emotions, and attitudes. I remember going to my mother one time, and I'll talk about this later, but I told her I was thinking about sex. And she said, oh my God, don't even think about that. It's not a good thing to think about. I tried not to. But she said, well, the only reason you ought to have sex is because you want to have children. Otherwise, it's a dirty, filthy, rotten thing to think about, she said. And
you ought to save it for the one you love.
Save it for the one you love, yeah, boy. No wonder my dad was in a nut house. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the spiritual knowledge of a 7-year-old boy. I had the fearful nature of a 7, 8, 9-year-old boy. I had the coping skills of an 8, 9, or 10-year-old boy. I had the sexual knowledge of an 8, 9, or 10-year-old boy. And you can imagine what those things were. And I learned my sexual knowledge on the streets from people that didn't know any more about it than I did. There was a place called Jenkins Cafe in West Tulsa. And a bunch of older men and women, 15, 16 years old. Very, very smart. And they knew all there was to know about these things. And they shared with me what they were up to, what they were doing. And some of the things they told me, my eyes got that big around. You know. So when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, age 34 years old, I had the sexual knowledge of a 10, 11-year-old boy that I learned off the streets from people that didn't know any more about it than I did. Do you think I didn't need inventory to find out what is true and what is false and what is right and what is wrong? I had no clue. I tried to live up to those ideals and I couldn't. So let's go back now to page 67 and we're going to talk about fears.
Remember, as we talked about those basic instincts of life, as we talked about the common manifestations of self, we had three common manifestations. One of them was resentments. And we had our little display cases up here filled with resentments. And the second one was fear. And we had a little file cabinet in this part of our store filled with fears. So the second common manifestation of self is fear. A person is living on self-will, can't depend on God, can't depend on other people, can't depend on themselves any longer. Their mind is absolutely riddled with fear. And fear controls and dominates the thinking, just like resentments did. If fear controls it and dominates it, then God can't. And it's just that simple. So we looked at resentments and got rid of them, so God can control that part of our mind. Now then, we're going to look at fears, and we're going to try to get rid of those, so God can control that part of our mind also. So let's go to the bottom of page 67. And let's start looking at fear.
One more thought. In my area of town, there was two kinds of people. There was people who ran home from school, and there was people who run people home from school. And that was me. Because I was so afraid that they were going to get me running, and I knew they wouldn't let up. So I became proactive, if you will. I began to threaten other people. And I did that all my life. And that's the main reason why I went to jail and other places. And Because if I perceived a threat from you, it was not good for you. I even had to think that there was a threat, and I'd jump right on you. And I used to do that kind of thing. And I see people today in grocery lines who are mad and stomping their feet and raising hell, and I know what they are. They're scared to death for some reason, just like I used to be. Fear is an evil and corroding threat. That's what our book says. Notice that the word fear is racked alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Miss Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think that fear ought to be classified for stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. And here are the instructions on how to fill out the form. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment or connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because that self-reliance failed? I didn't need God, nothing, or nobody. Self-reliant failed me. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse.
Okay, on that last paragraph that Joe just read, we see basically the same set of instructions to look at a fear that we had for resentments, except worded just a little bit differently, which is Bill's way of doing things. So to avoid any confusion, what we did is we made up another inventory sheet. Looks almost exactly like the resentment sheet, except we call it a review of fears. Have five columns in it. Column one, who or what do I fear? Column two, the cause of the fear. Column three, what part of self is affected? Column four, what did I do, if anything, to set it in motion? And column five, which character defect is involved in it? And we do it just exactly like we did the resentment sheet. We go to column one, working top to bottom, we make a list of our fears. Now, we men tend to say, well, we don't have much fear. We're tough. We're macho. But we're not talking so much about physical fears. We're talking about all those fears that run through our head that really control us and rule us and dominate our thinking. We all have a lot of fear. We have fears connected with our marriages. We have fears connected with our children. We have fears connected with our job. We have fears connected with the police department. We have fears connected with, and we could sit here all morning and talk about all the different kind of fears that we human beings have. All we really have to do column one, is just like with resentments. We take them out of our head, and we put them down on a sheet of paper. We'll give you an example of a couple of fears that most people have. Let's say in column one that I have a fear of my boss. Joe, let's put my boss in column one. Also, I may have fears connected with the police department, scared to death of the police. I could name just fear after fear after fear after fear after fear that really I used to have. Don't have them anymore, but used to have them. And just like with resentments, we're going to be amazed at how much fear we really do have and how much it controls and dominates our thinking. When we get them all down on a sheet of paper for the first time, you can only see one fear at a time in your head. We'll never realize and see how much fear we really do have, how much it controls us until we get them all down on paper and see them in their entirety for the first time. Now, we've made a decision to let God direct our thinking. If the fears direct our thinking, then God can't. You know, they came to me and they said, make a list of your fears. And I said, well, I don't have any fear. And they said, well, surely you do. And I said, well, if I do, I don't know. And this guy said, well, let me ask you a question. He said, are you afraid of snakes? And I said, yeah, hell yes, everybody's afraid of snakes. He said, write it down. And I wrote it down, and that opened the door. And then I just started putting down fear after fear after fear after fear after fear after fear. I was really amazed to see how much fear that I really did have. You know, I'd never really looked at that before. Column 2. By the side of each fear, we put down the cause of the fear. Now, we're not going to try to psychoanalyze. Like Joe said, I'm not going to say that I'm afraid of the dark because Mother set me sideways on the potty when I was 2 years old. Hell, some fear we're supposed to have anyhow. Fear brings caution. Fear can keep us out of trouble. Fear can keep us from getting hurt. Yeah, I'm a little bit afraid of the dark. Why? Well, I don't have headlights and I can't see at night. That brings caution and keeps me from getting hurt. I'm a little bit afraid of heights. Why? I don't have wings and I can't fly. That keeps me from getting hurt. But if those fears kept me from going outside after dark, if they kept me from riding in an elevator or an airplane, then I better look at them very, very closely because they're ruling and controlling and dominating my thinking. Most of my fears I have, there is a good cause behind it. For instance, we'll say I have a fear of my boss. What's the cause of that fear? What are they going to do to me? Am I perhaps going to jail? Am I going to lose something of material value? Am I going to lose face? Will it result in divorce? Will it destroy a personal relationship? Might I lose my job, etc.? So, for the fear of my boss, it might be that I'm scared to death he might fire me. And many people have that fear of their boss, which in many cases is a pretty good fear. Okay. I'm afraid of the police. Why? Well, they might put me in jail. That's why I'm afraid of them. Every one of those fears, there's usually a root cause behind it, and I can usually determine what it is in column 2. Then I go to column 3. What part of self is affected? You know, my boss, if he fires me, what part of self is going to be affected? That's a threat to my security, isn't it? It's a threat to my self-esteem, for sure. If the police put me in jail, that's a threat to my security also. It's also a threat to my self-esteem. Probably in both cases, it's a threat to my personal relationships and etc. But the side of each one of them, I put down a part of self that was affected, just like I did for resentments. And I'm going to be able to see one part of self really beginning to stand out. Maybe most of my fears are connected with security. Maybe most of them are connected with self-esteem and personal relationships. Maybe most of them are connected with sex. It's going to be a combination of all three. But at least one part of self is really going to stand out in this third column. And I can begin to see the part of self that's really giving me a hard time. Column 4, just like I did with resentments. I look at that fear honestly, and I look to see what did I do to set this thing in motion. Just like the book says, did we not ourselves set the ball rolling? What did I do, if anything, to set the ball rolling and set in motion trains of circumstances which have led to my being in a position to have the fear? You know, this fear that I have of my boss, I'm afraid he's going to fire me. That threatens my security, my self-esteem, etc. But what did I do to set that in motion? Well, hell, I'm always late to work. You know, I never get to work on time, and he's threatened me several times, and I'm scared to death that he really is going to fire me. I put myself in that particular position to be able to have to experience that fear. Same way with the police. You know, why am I so afraid the police might put me in jail? Well, hell, I'm always breaking the law. I'm breaking the speed limit. I'm always stealing. I'm always doing things I shouldn't be doing. I'm scared to death what they're going to do whenever they catch me. Almost invariably, for the majority of the fears, I find that I myself have done something to set the ball rolling, made decisions based on self. If I can't figure out what I did to cause the fear, then I just put down, I don't know. But in most cases, I can see where I put the ball rolling myself. Out in the fifth column, this deal with my boss. I'm always late to work. He's always threatening to fire me. It's always giving him a hard time, screwing him up emotionally. What character defect is involved? Would I be selfish under that condition? Certainly. Would I be inconsiderate under that condition? Certainly. Not worried about my boss, not worried about the job, not worried about the employer, doing it the way I want to do it myself, being selfish and inconsiderate of other human beings. Same old character defects. Just like with the police. You know, I'm always breaking the law, I'm always breaking the speed limit, I'm always stealing. Am I selfish in that particular case? Certainly. Am I inconsiderate of other human beings in that case? Certainly. Am I dishonest in that case? Certainly. Now see the same character defects out there in the fifth column that I had for resentments. Now if I wasn't so selfish, if I wasn't so dishonest, if I wasn't so self-seeking and frightened, if I wasn't so inconsiderate of other human beings, I wouldn't be doing the things which causes me to have to experience that fear. And if I don't have to experience that fear, then God can begin to direct a part of my thinking where fear used to direct it. But if I could become a little less selfish, you know, I wouldn't have to be experiencing so much fear. Most of my fears were connected around just one or two things anyhow. I was always scared to death I was going to lose something I already had. I was scared to death I wasn't going to get something I really wanted. Or I'd done something that I shouldn't have done to another human being or an institution. I'm scared to death what they're going to do whenever they catch me. Well, if I wasn't so selfish, I wouldn't have to be worried about all that kind of stuff. If I wasn't so dishonest, I wouldn't be doing the things I have to worry about what they're going to do if they catch me. If I wasn't such a self-seeking, frightened individual in the first place, I wouldn't have so much fear. If I was not so inconsiderate of other human beings, I wouldn't have to experience so much fear connected with the things that I do that create problems for other human beings. At the very least, I'm going to have to start working on some of that stuff out in that fifth column. If I don't, fear is going to continue to control me. It's going to continue to rule my thinking. It's going to block me off from God. And it's going to get me drunk just exactly like resentments did. Now, we're in the process of doing step four. This is the fears part of it. Out in the fifth column, we see the exact nature of the wrong. We'll talk to another human being about in step five. The fear is the wrong. That's what blocks me off from God. But what's the inherent characteristic of it? What's at the core of it? Well, it's that old personality of mine that I developed through my life, living a life run on self-will. That's what we'll talk about in step five. In the fifth column, we're going to see the character defects we're going to be willing to turn loose of in step six. In the fifth column, we're going to see the shortcomings we're going to ask God to take away in step seven, knowing full well that if I stay that way, I'm going to continue to do the same old things, and fear is going to eat me up, and eventually it's going to cause me to get drunk. So at the very least, I'm going to have to work on some of that stuff. If I could become a little less selfish, a little less dishonest, a little less self-seeking, frightened, a little less inconsiderate, then I wouldn't have to experience so much fear. And maybe it wouldn't block me off from God and cause me to get drunk. Now, some of the names in column one will be people and institutions that I fear. And I found out in column four that I myself did something to harm them and set this thing in motion, and I'm scared of what they're going to do when they catch me. So some of those names in column one will come off of column one and be added to the sheet to be used later on for steps 8 and 9. Just exactly like I did with resentments. And you know what really amazed me? Is I saw many of the same names appearing on the fear sheet that I had on the resentment sheet. I'd never tied that together in my head before. You know, I resented Barbara, but I feared Barbara also. I'm a little bit afraid of her today. If she ever finds out everything I was doing about 30-some-odd years ago, she's probably going to file for divorce again. I hated the Internal Revenue Service, resented them, and I feared the Internal Revenue Service. I resented the police department and I feared the police department. I was really amazed to see the same names in many cases appearing on the fear sheet that I had on the resentment sheet. I never had tied that together in my head before. Now, if you think resentments look dumb in your head whenever you see the truth behind them, wait till you get your fears down on this paper and see the truth behind those fears. And they look double dumb. All these fears look good in our head. But when you get them down on paper and see the real truth behind them, they look absolutely stupid in the majority of the cases. Once again, we alcoholics don't like to look dumb. And about 95% of these fears are going to begin to disappear automatically, just like resentments did, when we see the truth behind them. But once again, there's probably going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 fears that have been embedded in our minds so deeply for so long that seeing the truth behind them will not necessarily get rid of them. And for some of those, we're going to have a little extra help too. We now come to the second prayer in the big book. As far as our inventory is concerned, we had one for resentments. Now then, we have one to remove those deep-seated fears.
Remember, on the fears sheet, you notice that we want to use 1 or 2 or 3 words to describe the fears all the way across. No long dissertation. Don't have to write page after page after page of stuff. Just little words to remind yourself to talk about it when you get to step 5. And that's all they really are. See, simplicity. On page 68, perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For we're now on a different basis. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. Prior to AA, I didn't have any God in my life, so I couldn't trust God, so I trusted me. And that failed me, you see. Now I have made a step 3. Now I am trusting and relying upon God. We trust our infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. Now, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do.
Here comes the prayer.
We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. And at once, we commence to outgrow fear. Old Franklin told me, Joe, one time, a long time ago, he said, Joe, the two most important things about prayer, one was to start and the other was to continue. And as I look back in my life, I see that every time I have prayed, I've changed just a little bit, hardly noticeable to me or anybody else. And next time I pray, I change another little fuzz, hardly noticeable to me or anybody else. And as time goes by, I can see a major, major change in me. I'm not what I used to be, thank God. I'm just not what I used to be. And it's through prayer. Can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. Only God can heal a sick mind, you see.
We're always talking about the promises on page 83 and 84 in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Very seldom do you hear people talking about the promises that are spread throughout the entire book. Joe just read one of the greatest promises to be found anywhere in the book. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be instead. At once we commence to outgrow that fear. So we can use prayer here to get rid of the fears just the same as we use prayer to get rid of resentments. And if we ask God to remove that fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be, then immediately we begin to outgrow that fear. I had a woman up in New York City. We did a big book study up there. And she came up to me and she said, Charlie, I'm scared to death to ride the subway system. She said, I don't have a car. The bus system's not too good, and it's really hard for me to get around town. She said, I just can't hardly go anywhere because of that fear of the subway system. What can I do about it? I said, well, you do what the book says to do about it. I said, you ask God to direct your to remove that fear and direct your attention to what He would have you be instead, and at once you'll commence to outgrow that fear. And I gave her my name and address, and I said, why don't you call me in 2 or 3 weeks and let me know how you're doing? And she called me in 2 or 3 weeks, and she was just so happy and excited. She said, I'm riding that damn subway system all over town. You know, this thing really does work.
She looked like Abraham.
It really, really does work. Now, just think. This file cabinet that was filled with fears before, I have now removed those fears. As I did the inventory process, they looked so stupid, 95% of them disappeared. The other 5% can be removed through prayer, and that means that that file cabinet has now been emptied out. And there's always another law that applies here, a natural law that says the nature abhors a vacuum. You know, God's not going to leave in that hole in my head. I've got enough of those already. If those fears disappear, they're going to have to be replaced with something else. Just like when resentments disappeared, they were replaced with love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill. As the fears disappear, they're going to be replaced with faith and courage. And the part of my mind that used to be controlled by fear now is directed by God's thinking, which is faith and courage. I find that I'm able to do many, many things that I was always afraid to do before. Just as importantly, I find that I'm able to quit doing some things that I was always afraid to quit before. This thing really, really does work. But also like resentments. If you've got a fear in your mind that you don't want to get rid of, then you better get it down on this piece of paper and really, really take a look at it. And really try to see the truth behind it. Because we can use fear for rationalization and justification, just like we use resentments for the same thing. And we can use fear to rationalize doing things that we really shouldn't even be doing. Just as importantly, we can use fear to rationalize not doing things we really would like to do. Let me give you, for instance, I'm going to ask you a question. Please be honest with me. How many of you in this room this morning would like to go back to school and finish your education? Could I see your hands? Just look at them all over the room. I'm going to ask you another question. Now, please be honest with me. How many of you really intend to do that? Could I see your hands? Probably less than 20% of the hands went up this time. Why? Nothing in the world but fear. Fear that we won't measure up. Fear of failure, fear of hard work, keeps us from doing things we really would like to do. And when that happens to us, then fear is controlling, ruling, and dominating our thinking for us. And if fear does, then God can't. All my life I've loved to work with my hands. I always wanted to build a set of kitchen cabinets. But I was always afraid to build them because I knew they wouldn't look very good. There would be a lot of mistakes and people would laugh at them. After I came to AA and worked this program for quite some time, one day I decided to build a set of kitchen cabinets. Now, they don't look very good. There's a lot of mistakes in them and people laugh at them, but I don't give a damn anymore. I'm not that afraid of what people think anymore.
I had a young fellow named Todd. He was 29 years old and sober 2 years, several years ago, 17 as a matter of fact. And I said, Todd, you're unemployed and unemployable. What are you going to do with your life? He said, well, I don't know. I said, what have you would like to do? He said, I would really like to be an engineer. And I said, well, why don't you become an engineer? And he said, Joe, I don't even have a high school education. I said, well, you can get your GED, begin there. And he said, do you have any idea how old I'll be time I get to be an engineer? I said, do you have any idea how old you're going to be anyhow? Yeah. Engineer or not? Well, Todd was not dumb. He was uneducated. But he got his GED. He went to Tulsa Junior College. Got on the Dean's Honor Roll. got a scholarship at the University of Tulsa Engineering School, which is one of the toughest engineering schools in America, I guess. And he graduated with that with honors. Eventually, he went out to California. He worked for an engineering company, continued his education, and finally he got to be a full-fledged engineer. Called me just before Christmas, 17 years later, which I talked to him many times, but 17 years later, he said, "Joe, I graduated this month. I'm a full-fledged engineer." Do what you want to do.
You see, I don't think any of us can ever realize what fear does to us and how much it really does control our lives and dominate our thinking until we get this stuff down on paper and see the truth behind it. And then we're absolutely amazed to see what we've been letting fear do to us. We didn't realize what resentments were doing to us. We don't realize what fear does to us until we inventory those things and see the truth behind them. And usually we're absolutely amazed when we do so. Now, 2/3 of my store I've got straightened up. The resentments were replaced with love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill. Fears have been replaced by faith and courage. But also there was a third common manifestations of self, which is the guilt and remorse that I feel associated with the harms I've done to others in the past during my life run on self-will. Remember, we had a storeroom back here in the back of our head that's filled with that guilt and that remorse. We're not drunken bums. We've got a conscience. And that guilt and remorse just literally tends to eat us up. So if I want God to direct that part of my thinking, I'm going to have to do something about emptying out that storeroom too. And the first thing I have to do is I have to take an honest look at it. Just like an honest look at resentments, an honest look at fears. Now, it seems as though we human beings hurt other people in the sexual area faster than we do any other way. It seems as though we feel more guilt and more remorse from those things than we do in any other way. And I think there's some good reasoning behind that. You know, the other animals here on earth, they have the same sex urge that we human beings have, so they can reproduce themselves. But when it comes time for them to reproduce themselves, they don't have this thing called self-will that we human beings have. They don't really have much choice in the situation. When it comes time for them to reproduce themselves, God usually signifies that by some physical change in the female of the species. The male senses that change, prepares himself. The two join together, and it's kind of like bang, bang, thank you, ma'am, and when it's over with, they normally go their separate ways. You see, they didn't think about having sex before they had it. They couldn't decide when they're going to have sex. In a majority of the cases, they can't decide who they're going to have sex with. They usually can't decide whether they're going to have sex with one or more partners. They can't decide what position they're going to have sex in. Therefore, you see very few sexual problems amongst the other animals here on earth. I've never seen a cow on a psychiatrist's couch yet talking about sexual dysfunction. This doesn't happen for them. We human beings are a little bit different. You know, God also gives us the sex urge so that we could reproduce ourselves. But He gives us something He doesn't give to the other animals. He gives us this thing called self-will. And He allows us to make our own decisions about our sex life. You know, we can decide whenever we're going to have sex. We can have sex any day of the year we want to. We can decide who we're going to have sex with. We can decide whether we're going to have sex with one or more partners. We can decide how many times we're going to have sex, providing we're physically capable of doing so. Well, we could even decide what position we're going to have sex in. You know, they tell me there's something like 64 different positions a human being can have sex in. I have no idea what they are. I only found 3 in my lifetime. And two of those damn near killed me. I'm not sure I'm going back to them. So what we're going to do here for just a few minutes this morning is we're going to look at our sex life, and we're going to look more at how we think about sex than how we do sex. Because how we think about it is going to determine what we do with it. And that in turn determines whether it's going to end up hurting other people or not. And then that determines whether we're going to have to suffer the fear and the guilt and remorse associated with those things. And I'm always amazed when I look at this stuff in the big book and see how Bill laid this out for us. A very simple process, letting us look at our own past sex life, letting us get an idea of what we have caused and what we've become and perhaps what we should do to change it in the future. And he does it in such a way that it really never offends anybody. I'm amazed by it. The bottom of page 68. Now about sex. Many of us need an overhauling there. Now you older fellows, don't get your hopes up. We're talking about mental, not physical. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cried that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. I've heard them all my life. They're the ones who say sex is a dirty thing. You ought to do it at one time, in one position, with one person only. And the only reason to do it is to reproduce yourself. And if you enjoy it, it's a sinful thing. I've heard them as far back as I can remember. They are to the extremes on one side. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. And maybe today they would call that the sexual revolution. You hear them saying you ought to be able to have sex anytime you want to, as many times as you want to, with anybody you want to, in any position you want to, and you ought to be able to enjoy it, and if you don't, there must be something wrong with you. Main thing I see wrong with it, it happened 25 years too late for me to participate in it, I know that. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? And I read that last sentence with great relief, because I knew this book was getting ready to condemn me for what I had been in the past. I knew it was getting ready to tell me what I was going to have to do in the future. And I'd made up my mind that I wasn't going to pay any attention to it at all. I'm glad to find out we're not going to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We're simply not going to get into that question of what's right and what's wrong. This book is meant to be helpful to anybody, anywhere. And if we start trying to tell people how to conduct their sex life, then surely we're going to begin to alienate people. Besides that, what is sexually acceptable in one part of the world may not be acceptable at all in another part of the world. So we're simply not going to get into that question. What we are going to do is see a way to look at our own past sex conduct, to see if perhaps we've harmed some other people through the usage of that stuff, to see if maybe we can't shape a new sex life in the future where we can still engage in it, still enjoy it, yet at the same time not hurt other people. And that's the key thing, because if we hurt others, then we get to feel the guilt and remorse. We get to feel the fear of what they're going to do when they find out about this stuff. And eventually that blocks us off from God, and sooner or later gets us drunk, Joe.
I'm not going to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. When I tell you about where I got my information, you'll not want to know anything from me about it, I can tell you that. I'm going to do what the book says, though. and I like the way they produce it and present it. I'm going to find the facts. I'm going to face the facts. I'm engaged in a process to accept the facts. Certainly, I need an overhauling, and I told you a little bit about that a while ago. I'm going to look at my ideas, my emotions, and my attitudes about it, and where I got them and how I acquired them, to see if they're right or they're wrong for me. And that's all I'm going to do. And I remember the first time I got married, I was okay there for a couple of years, and then I went out on my wife one night, drinking and drunk and all that. And the next day, I felt bad. I felt real bad. I didn't know you were supposed to feel bad. Nobody ever told me that. But I did. Felt that guilt, shame, and remorse. It's supposed to keep you from doing it again, but it didn't. And the next time I went out, it wasn't quite so bad as it was the first time. And the next time, it wasn't quite so bad as the second time. And as the years went by, it got to where it didn't hurt at all. And then I found another little experience. See, if you don't have any principles to live by, ultimately you won't have any reason to live. Such are principles. I compromised every principle known to man and God. And finally, there toward the end, I didn't have any principles to live by. Compromised everything, don't have any reason to live either. And that's where I found myself in the end of my drinking and the things that I did.
You know, when we went to school back in grade school, junior high and high school, we didn't have sex education in school in those days like they have it today. We had sex education all right, but we called it recess.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have any actual physical, any actual teachings from teachers or anybody else about a sex life. You could hardly talk to your mother and father about it. Just like Joe said, he went to his mother and asked her about sex, and Mama been thinking about sex.
Scared her.
And she said, "Oh my God, Benny Joe, that's a terrible thing to think about it. It's a dirty, filthy, rotten, nasty thing. And you're only supposed to do it to reproduce yourself, and you're supposed to save it for the one that you love. Dirty, filthy, rotten, nasty thing, and save it for the one you love." So we didn't have any way to learn about sex except talk to the older boys. And every city that I've ever been in, there was always a Jenkins Cafe somewhere. And there was always a bunch of those kids standing out in front of that cafe on Friday night, Saturday night, and etc. And us kids that were 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, we go to those 14, 15, 16-year-old kids.
Experienced.
And we ask them about sex. Well, they were more than happy to share their knowledge with us. They told us about how many girls they were having sex with every night. They told us about how many different times they were having sex. And our eyes would get just about that big around. And then, of course, as we began to grow up, and we tried to fulfill what they said that they did. Hell, I was in AA 4 or 5 years before I figured out those guys were lying to me.
I hope they were.
I hope to hell they were lying to me, because I never could live up to that. And, of course, we really didn't know anything about sex. We got to AA, even though we were adults, we still had the spiritual knowledge of 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old kids that grew up on the streets and learned about sex through recess and etc. Joe just loves to tell you about the first time he ever had sex. You know, very interesting.
Well, the truth is that Charlie likes me to tell you about the first time I had sex. I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, inconsiderate, and alone. Do you think I don't need an inventory about sex?
That's why he's wearing glasses today, too. Every time we say that, I look out there and about a half a dozen of you guys have jerked your glasses off and put them in your pocket.
Do you get that? You jerk your glasses off?
Okay.
All right. How many of you got your sexual information somewhat like Charlie and I did? Somewhat like we did, our sexual information.
Okay, now we see if the directions to review our past sex life. They look almost exactly like those for resentments, except worded a little differently, which is Bill's way of doing things. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Well, that's column 5. Whom had we hurt? That's column 1. Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Column 4. Where are we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So we just made up another little inventory sheet. Looks almost like the resentment sheet, except it's a review of our past sex conduct. Column 1, who did I hurt? I doubt if there's anybody in this room that ever hurt anybody in the sexual area that we don't know just exactly who that is. You know, that seems to be a form of knowledge that we all have. And if we've hurt them, we usually know what we've done to do so. Now, there may be some question as to, well, what do we do that hurts people in the sexual area? In many ways. And if I go outside of my marriage and I have sex out there, and my wife finds out about it, then surely I've created a problem for my wife. If not physically, at least emotionally. If there's children in my home, and that sexual escapade out there creates a real rift between my wife and I, then I've hurt my children by the same sex act. If the lady I had sex with out there, if it becomes common knowledge, I've hurt her too. And if she has a husband and children, I've hurt them also. You know, one sex act could hurt several different people. I think sometimes we hurt people in a sexual area simply by demanding more than our fair share. Maybe our partner isn't too keen about having sex every time we want to. Rather than consider their needs and wants and desires, we selfishly demand that they have sex with us and they really don't want to. Surely that creates a problem for them, if not physically, at least emotionally. I think sometimes we hurt people in a sexual area by demanding they have sex with us in ways they don't really want to. And rather than consider their needs and wants, we selfishly demand those things. Surely we create a problem for them, if not physically, at least emotionally. I think sometimes we hurt people in a sexual area simply by withholding sex. You know, maybe we're not too keen about having sex every time our partner wants to, and we selfishly withhold when perhaps we should give in a little more often. Rather than consider our wants, consider their needs and wants and desires. Many ways we hurt people in a sexual area. I think we all know what they are. Column 1, we just make a list of those that we've harmed through our sexual conduct of the past. And once again, you don't see the full truth behind any of this stuff till you get it all down on paper. You only see one at a time in your head. But if you list them on paper, you begin to realize the extent of the damage that perhaps we've done to others through our own sex conduct. Column 2. By the side of each name, I put down what I did to hurt them. Did I demand they have sex with me when I didn't want to? Did I commit adultery? Did I force them to have sex in ways that they didn't want to? If I know the name of the one I've hurt, I also know what I did to hurt them. Column 2 is very simple. Column 3. Now, I think this third column might be one of the best things we can ever do for ourselves as far as looking at our past sex life is concerned. Now, you would think if I hurt anybody in the sexual area that it would be caused by the sex instinct. And I guess once in a while that's probably true. Sometimes to get the physical and emotional gratification that comes at the moment of successful completion of the sex act, I might be doing the wrong thing at the wrong time with the wrong person because of the sex instinct. But I think if we carefully look at each situation, we're going to find that the other two instincts are usually involved just as much as sex. And maybe even more so. And in some cases, sex really didn't have a hell of a lot to do with it. Now, I'm going to express an opinion. And I want to be sure that everybody understands it's my opinion, not AA's, not Joe's, just mine. I'm convinced today that God gave us the sex urge so that we could reproduce ourselves. I'm also convinced that He made it a very pleasurable thing so we would do so. I don't think you and I would do the kind of work involved in sex if we didn't get some kind of reward for doing so. And one of the greatest pleasures we can have is the feeling both emotionally and physically at the moment of successful completion of the sex act. Now, if we're doing sex for purposes other than reproduction or enjoyment, we just might be doing sex for purposes other than what God intended. For instance, we boys learned at a very early age that you can use sex to build your self-esteem. After all, the more members of the opposite sex you can attract to yourself, the greater man you really are, we thought. And we boys call that John Wayneism. I don't know what you girls call it, but some of you tell me you use sex for the same purposes.
Jane Wayne.
Jane Wayne, Joe said. Now, if we're using sex to build our self-esteem, then that's not to reproduce, that's not necessarily enjoy, but that's to fulfill a part of the social instinct. Sex really doesn't have a hell of a lot to do with that. Sometimes we use sex to buy a personal relationship. Maybe we're just lonesome. We just want somebody to pay attention to us. We found a long time ago we can give sex and buy back a personal relationship. Now, that has nothing to do with reproduction or enjoyment. That's also to fulfill a part of the social instinct. Sometimes we use sex to fulfill a part of the security instinct. You know, maybe we're in a sexual situation we really would rather not even be in. We become so overly dependent upon another human being for our material well-being that we give sex to buy back security. Sex really doesn't have a hell of a lot to do with that. It has nothing to do with enjoyment or reproduction, but it's to fulfill the security instinct. Now, sometimes we use sex to get even with another human being. Maybe our partner's gone out and done something they shouldn't have done. And we say, we'll show them. And we'll go out and do the same identical thing to get even with them. And the fallacy in it is after we've done it, we can't afford to tell them we did it. But there, we didn't use sex to reproduce or enjoy. We used it to get even with another human being. Sometimes we use sex to force our will on another human being. Maybe our partner isn't doing what we think they ought to be doing. And we say, we'll show them. We'll just cut them off at the pass. And we won't let them have any sex until they come around to our way of thinking. Now, we boys aren't too good at that. We only last 2 or 3 days. But you girls have honed it to perfection. You know exactly how to do that. And there we're using sex not to reproduce, not to enjoy, but to force our will on another human being. I was absolutely amazed when I started filling out that third column. Two things happened to me immediately at that third column. The first thing is a lot of my guilt began to disappear. I thought I was just a dirty, rotten, no good SOB. But I found out that I use sex for purposes other than what God intended. Not because I'm a bad human being, because I'm a sick human being. And when I could see that, then a lot of my guilt began to disappear. Another thing that happened to me is I always thought I was oversexed. No, I wasn't oversexed. I was undersecure. And I used that sex to build my security, to build my self-esteem, and etc. And when I began to see what I was really using sex for, the desire to go do it at the wrong time, in the wrong place, with the wrong people, become less and less and less, and I began to get a little handle on that sex thing right here in this third column when I saw what I was really using it for. Now, I can't speak for you ladies, but I can speak for we men. And most of us, our problems with sex revolves around self-esteem. Sex doesn't have a hell of a lot to do with it. We use the sex to build our self-esteem. We measure our manhood by how sexually virile we really are. You know, and I was amazed to see that. I didn't know that at all. So I learned something good in the third column. Column four. I put down, what feelings did I create in others? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? What should I have done instead? You know, not only are we looking what we've done in the past, we're trying to shape a new sex life for the future. So we need to be looking at the idea of what should we be doing rather than so much of what we've done in the past, because we're going to try to shape a new sex life in the future where we can still engage in it, still enjoy it, yet end up not hurting other people. Column five. Same character defects. Where had I been selfish? Where had I been dishonest? Where had I been self-seeking and frightened? Where had I been inconsiderate? Which of the above character defects caused me to do what I did to harm another human being? I fill them out just exactly like I did with the resentment sheet. I look out in that fifth column and I can see, if I stay selfish, or if I stay dishonest, or if I stay self-seeking and frightened, or if I stay inconsiderate, I'm going to keep right on doing the same old things I've always done. Keep right on hurting people. They're going to retaliate. I'm going to resent. Fear and guilt and remorse is going to eat me up. And eventually it's going to cause me to end up going back to drinking again over and over and over again. Now, we're in the process of doing step four again. This is a sexual conduct part of it. In the fifth column, we now see the exact nature of the wrong we'll talk about in five. A guy comes to me with his inventory. I don't care how many times he's committed adultery. What I'm interested in is what's within him that causes that. Is he doing it just plain old selfishness? Is he doing it through fear? Is he doing it through inconsideration of others? That's what we'll talk about in step five. In the fifth column, I see the character defects I'm willing to turn loose of in step six. Knowing full well if I don't turn loose of those things, I keep doing the same old things over and over. In the fifth column, I see the shortcomings I'm going to ask God to take away in step seven. Quite naturally, the names in column one, we're going to be people I've harmed, and their names will come off of column one and be added to the sheet to be used later on for steps eight and nine. When we get to step eight, the book says we've got the list, we made it, and we took step four. And you know, I was amazed, once again, to see in many cases the same names appearing on all three sheets. You know, I resented Barbara, I feared Barbara, and I certainly hurt Barbara in this area. I even had the Internal Revenue Service on all three sheets. I resented them, and I feared them, and I gave them a pretty good screwing before I got through with them, too. All right. Now, the book says in this way, in this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. Here we see prayer again here in step four. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed.
You used prayer three different times, and that was the first prayer. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. More prayer. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. Now, God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with others is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice.
You know, I think this is an area that we don't need of a lot of advice. I think each of us down inside, we really know what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. I've never been in a sexual situation yet that was wrong, that I didn't know it was wrong before I ever got into it. Didn't keep me from getting into it, but I already knew it was wrong. I don't think we need a lot of advice in this area. Besides that, you run around and start asking people for advice in the sexual area. If you ask four people, you'll probably get four different answers. And then you're going to have to decide which one of those answers you're going to use. And I can't think of a worse place to get sexual advice anyhow than Alcoholics Anonymous. I think let's just listen to that little voice inside and we'll know what's right and what's wrong.
I got a guy that I sponsored about 6 weeks ago now. He went out on his wife and she caught him. And he was telling me about it, and I said, well, why did you do it? He said it was an accident. How did that happen? Anyhow, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Well, some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we're sorry for what we've done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we'll be forgiven and have learned our lesson. Now, if we're not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we're quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts of our experience. Now, to sum up about sex, more prayer. We earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the horny condition. No, it quiets the imperious urge, excuse me. When to yield would mean heartache.
Okay. We're going to look at one more little inventory sheet. Remember, step 8 says we got the list, we made it, and we took step 4. Some of the people we've harmed came off column 1 in the resentment sheet. Some came off of column 1 in the fear sheet. And some of them came off of column 1 in the sex sheet. But there's probably going to be some other people that we have harmed in ways other than sexual that haven't really appeared on any one of these three sheets yet. So in order to complete the inventory, we're going to suggest we make up one more little inventory sheet. We call it a review of harms other than sexual. And any names that we know that we've hurt them that haven't appeared on any of the three sheets up to now, we make a list of them in column 1. And then in column 2, we put down by the side of each name, what did I do to harm them? And then in column 3, which part of self caused me to do so? And in column 4, what feelings did I create in others? Then in column 5, which character defect was involved? Just like we did for resentments, just like we did for fears, just like we did for sexual harms. Again, we're dealing with step 4. The 5th column, we see all the information we'll need for 5, 6, and 7. And in the 1st column, those names will be added to the list to be used later on for steps 8 and 9. When we do that, we have completed our inventory. We've reviewed the resentments. We've reviewed the fears. We've reviewed the sexual harms. We've reviewed the harms other than sexual. And by now, we should really be getting a handle on those things within us that causes us to have those resentments and those fears and those harms done to other people. By now we should be beginning to see the things within us that we're going to have to change if we want peace of mind and serenity and happiness in the future. Page 70, last paragraph. If we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. Now, he doesn't say so, but we've listed and analyzed our fears. We've listed and analyzed our sexual harms. We've listed and analyzed our harms other than sexual. Now, to analyze something simply means to get down to the truth of it. This is another word that Bill uses that means truth. We've taken a truthful, honest, moral, analytical inventory. We've tried to see the truth behind all these things. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. Now, here's the positive happening. Every action step has a positive happening in it. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. My God, what a personality change for an alcoholic to begin to learn some tolerance, patience, goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. See, we don't have to wait till step 12 to get something out of this. The personality changes as we go through the program. We're building the wonderfully effective spiritual structure. We've listed the people we've hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision,
step 3,
and an inventory of your grosser handicaps,
step 4,
you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. And one of the greatest mistakes that we see people making in step 4 is everybody wants to sit down and put off step 4 and procrastinate and procrastinate until they can do it perfect. We'll never do it perfect. We do the best we absolutely